The following message is from Pastor Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
Let's take a look at verses 22 and 30 to 31, and then we're going to go back earlier to some of the earlier verses as we go along here. But I want to particularly read through the actual wrestling match that Jacob had with God. Starting in verse 22, that night Jacob got up and looked and got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he was wrestling with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God, with humans, and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God's face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. I think in order to understand what is happening here, we need to look at everything that happened in Jacob's life up to this moment. Throughout his entire life, Jacob has been calculating and maneuvering to secure the life that he wants. It starts at birth when he comes out of Rebekah's womb, clutching his twin brother Esau's heel. Jacob's name actually means heel grabber. One, in other words, who tries to outmaneuver and outperform others. He, in fact, later on in his life, will steal Esau's birthright using a bowl of lentil soup to entice him. And he conspires with his mother, Rebekah, to deceive his father, Isaac, stealing his older brother's blessing. And even when God will appear to him at Bethel, promising to watch over him wherever he goes, even there, Jacob's response to God is essentially to strike a deal with him. Verse 20 of Genesis chapter 28 says, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God.'" He puts a condition on God. And so for the next 20 years, Jacob will enter into this extended chess match with his uncle Laban, because the two of them are master manipulators. And they're basically, for the next two decades, trying to outwit and outmatch each other. Laban will trick Jacob into marrying the wrong daughter, as you may know. And Jacob will use selective breeding techniques to grow a much healthier and larger herd than Laban. And they just go at it like this for 20 years until finally they realize we just need some personal space here and some separation. And so they make this uneasy covenant with each other at this place called Mizpah. And now, a wealthy man, Jacob decides that it is the right time for him to return back home. But he knows he has a problem there because his brother Esau waits for him, the same brother that he has cheated twice. And so he sends word ahead of the arrival just to get a feel of what reception he might get when he gets there. And in Genesis 32, 3-5, it says, "Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, 'This is what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants, Now I am sending this message to my Lord that I may find favor in your eyes. This is Jacob, always the hustler, figuring out the right way to do this. And he is essentially telling his brother three things in this message. One, I have not been hiding from you. I've been in plain sight all along. I've been staying with our uncle, Laban. And then secondly, he says, I am not going to try to take anything from you. I have plenty of animals on my own. I am not a threat to you. And then three, can we just let the past be the past and let bygones be bygones and just start with a blank slate? And in verse 6, it says this. When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him. That is not the response that Jacob wanted to hear. He is terrified when he receives this news. Why is Esau coming with a small army? What are his intentions? It's not clear. Does he come in peace or come with war? And so what he does immediately is he divides his entire estate into two camps and separates them, thinking that if one gets attacked and slaughtered, maybe the other side has a chance of survival. And then he offers this interesting prayer to God in Genesis 32, verse 9 through 11. Then Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I have only my staff when I cross this Jordan, but now I've become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper. You will and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. Listen, Jacob is not a man of prayer. The only other recorded prayer of Jacob in his life is 20 years ago, the prayer that we just read in chapter 28. And then fast forward 20 years, and this is only the second time that Jacob prays. But he is desperate, and in his desperation, he turns to God for help. And it's hard to know how sincere Jacob's prayer is here, but what I find interesting is he doesn't say, my God, but he says, the God of my father and the God of my grandfather. And then he seems to invoke the promise that God made to him 20 years earlier as leverage, pressing God to help him in this moment, despite the fact that he has spent his entire life living in rebellion to God, not doing anything that could be even deemed as acknowledging God in his life. And not surprisingly, after he prays that prayer, Jacob goes into full crisis management mode. And he basically tries to devise a plan that will get himself out of this mess that he has dug for himself. What he does is he sends a huge number of his animals ahead of him. And he does so, interestingly, in five separate waves that are separated from one another. And historians tell us that this was actually a really smart strategy. Because as each of these successive waves shows up to Esau, the intention is, first of all, I think, basically to soften Esau's heart. But it also has the effect of slowing him down, doesn't it? And he has to stop and now deal with each of these waves of animals. And now he's traveling with all of these noisy animals. And it would have disrupted whatever type of military formation he may have been organizing and maybe even basically foil any kind of a surprise attack that he had planned. And then it's also told that Jacob not only sends his animals, but also his servants ahead in these waves. And so now Jacob's servants are intermingling with Esau's camp. And that would also make a coordinated or sneak attack very difficult to pull off. You see, once again, Jacob is working the angles, trying to give himself whatever advantage he can to survive the situation. Because the truth is, he has spent his entire life in survival mode, maneuvering to make life work on his own terms. And having sent his animals and his servants and his family ahead of him to Esau, Jacob now finds himself alone in the dark. And being stripped of everything that he possesses, everything that he cares for in his life, I think that had left him exposed in a way that he had never experienced up to then. And in that lonely night, you wonder what thoughts must have crossed his mind. He spent his entire life trying to force it to work in his favor. And now he stands on the verge of possibly losing it all. All because of a threat of his own making by the way that he treated his brother. And basically, Jacob has no cards left to play. He has no moves that can get him out of this mess. And interesting, that's when God shows up as a man and begins wrestling with him. The fight begins with Jacob struggling against this mysterious stranger, holding his own in the darkness, refusing to be pinned by him. What's important, though, is that the stranger's inability to overcome Jacob cannot refer to a physical limitation. Because, as you know, at the end of the fight, this guy demonstrates exactly how easily he could defeat Jacob if he wanted to. I think when it says that he could not overcome, it was more the fact that Jacob was not willing to yield to God. It's as if God is saying to Jacob by wrestling with him, you have been wrestling your entire life with the world. But not only the world, you've been wrestling with me. But if I am ever to overcome in this struggle with you, you are the one that has to surrender. You must finally let go of the struggle. And so they wrestle all night, but as dawn approaches, the man simply touches the hip of Jacob and dislocates it. And immediately, the contest is essentially over. And Jacob has no hope of winning this wrestling match. Barely able to stand, he clings desperately to the man. And the man tells him, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob, limping, exhausted, clings to him and says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." You see, the fight began with Jacob trying to prevail over God. But now he holds on to God for dear life, knowing that he cannot win this fight, but instead begging for a blessing. For the first time in his life, Jacob has abandoned any effort to fight his way out of his situation and instead throws himself on the mercy of God. And God responds to Jacob's desperate cry for a blessing with a question that must have hit him really hard. "What is your name? What is your name?" Jacob says, "I am Jacob, the heel grabber, the deceiver, the manipulator, the one who has tried to maneuver everyone who has ever stood in my way." And I think this is a powerful moment of self-awareness, a confession of what he has been his entire life. He has spent his whole life believing that other people were the obstacles standing between him and the life that he so desperately wanted. He had built this entire narrative around blaming others. It was his father's favoritism that he was trying to overcome. It was Laban's manipulations and the unfairness of an entire life in which the world was stacked against him. But in that dark and lonely wilderness, he was finally confronted with the reality of his own brokenness. "I am Jacob. This is who I am." And in that moment, God gives him a new name. "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." In the ancient world, when someone changes your name, It was a way of expressing authority over that person. And Jacob accepting this new name meant that he was accepting this authority that was being placed on him. But not only that, but also the new identity given to him by God, rather than one that he had constructed for himself. It is interesting to me that in this story, God takes Jacob's greatest flaw, which was his stubborn, relentless refusal to let go of the things that he wanted, and he transformed it into a perseverance of faith that clung on to God and refused to let go. In other words, in God's hands, his character flaw was transformed actually into a virtue. C.S. Lewis writes in Screwtape Letters, "When God talks of their losing themselves, he means only abandoning the clamor of self-will. Once they have done that, he really gives them back all their personality and boasts that when they are wholly his, they will be more themselves than ever." I think the idea of surrendering ourselves to God actually terrifies a lot of us, because we fear that in that process, we are going to actually lose our identity, lose who we really want to be. But God is not interested in amputating what is broken in us, but in redeeming and transforming it so that he can use it for his glory. In other words, you will still be you in that surrender, but it will be the best version of you that you never thought possible. In accepting the new name that God gave him, Jacob, for the first time, is also accepting the truth that he is not the author of his own story. Every struggle to accept our life circumstances is at its deepest level a struggle with God. Jacob struggles with Esau. He struggles with Laban. He even struggles with his wives that are rivaling against each other. What he realizes is that it just wasn't only about that. At the deepest level, he was struggling with God. His fundamental question all of his life seemed to have been, is God reliable? Will he truly provide for me? Can I trust the blessings that he has given me will come to pass without me having to engineer it on my own? You know, I think part of Jacob's problem was the way that he defined success in his life. From the very beginning of his life, he believed that fulfillment could be found if he could just secure the right blessings, the right achievements. He spent years chasing his father's approval. Bless me, God. Bless me, Dad. Bless me. Of accumulating wealth through his scheming and his hard works and pursuing the woman of his dreams. And the truth is, one by one, he eventually obtained everything that he was seeking. Jacob believed that those things would make him whole. But despite gaining all of it, he remained restless and fearful and deeply broken. Can I ask you a question? How do you measure progress in your life? By what measure do you feel that life has been successful for you? Because I think our culture has set some pretty clear milestones for all of us that supposedly define what it means to be a successful person. We're all expected to get married, aren't we? And then we're all expected to have healthy children. And we're supposed to land a good job and then climb the corporate ladder and then buy a home in the right neighborhood and then get your kids into the best schools. And I want to ask you, what if your life doesn't unfold according to that script? I think the truth is, it can feel devastating, can't it? It can feel as if your entire life has been a failure. But I want to ask you another question. What do you think are the milestones that God uses when he evaluates your life? Because I want to say that the milestones that God uses has almost nothing to do with the way that the world will assess your life. The singular milestone God uses to measure our lives is the degree to which we are becoming more like Jesus. That's it. Period. Full stop. The story of your life, written from God's perspective, centers completely around the singular goal of shaping you into His image. That's it. That is God's measure of success for you. Whether you ever become married, whether you ever bear children, whether you are finding yourself jobless in middle age, what God will use to measure whether your life was a success or not is whether you reflect the image of His Son. In February 2006, John Piper wrote an article called "Don't Waste Your Cancer." And he wrote it on the night before he was undergoing surgery for his own prostate cancer. And in that article, he writes, "I believe in God's power to heal by miracle and by medicine. I believe it is right and good to pray for both kinds of healing. Cancer is not wasted when it is healed by God. He gets the glory, and that is why cancer exists. So not to pray for healing may waste your cancer, but healing is not God's plan for everyone. And there are many other ways to waste your cancer. I am praying for myself and for you that we will not waste this pain." When I read these words, I was just disoriented. I was like, who talks like this? Wasting your cancer? As if it was like a gift and you don't want to spoil it? Piper is reframing his battle with cancer not as a problem to be solved, but as an opportunity to learn and grow so that he will bring glory to God through that trial. Because Piper's greatest fear is not that the cancer will kill him, but that he could go through that entire painful process and gain nothing spiritually from it. And I think that fear is well-founded, because the truth is most of us go through those kind of seasons in our life in survival mode, coming out on the other side, not having learned anything. Still fundamentally the same person when we started that journey. I don't know if you or your loved one is going to be cured of that illness or land that job that they desperately need. I don't know if your kids are going to get into their dream schools. There are no guarantees here. But what I do know is that every one of those moments that you face is an opportunity to learn and grow and to become more like Jesus. This is what it means to be a disciple. As His apprentices, Jesus is most interested in the kind of people we are becoming. And for this project, He will use everything, even our failures and our pains, to grow us into His image. When you're going through challenges and trials, I think the most natural question to ask yourself is, how do I get out of this? I think a slightly more mature question in those same circumstances is, how do I get through this? But I think the disciples' question is, what is God doing in me through this? Romans 8, 28 to 29 says, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. For those God foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son." Notice two things in these verses. First, notice that He says all things. All things. Not just the things that seem spiritually significant to you, but all things, even in the stuff that feels so random and meaningless and pointless. The truth is, in all things, God is working for your good. There are no meaningless circumstances in your life. In the hands of God, everything is redeemed for His purpose. I am not saying that God causes trials in your life just to grow your faith, although He may do that, but it does mean that He can redeem even the most difficult seasons of your life for His good. And then second thing to notice in this passage is that the good that He is achieving is found at the end of this passage, conforming us into the image of His Son. I think most of us think about God's goodness toward us in terms of favorable circumstances, like good health, stable finances, or healthy relationships. Those things are part of the good that God may give us, but the primary good that God is working toward is our Christ-likeness. His unrelenting project is to make us more like Jesus. And the truth is that often requires the very things that we are most desperately praying that he would remove. But he allows those thorns to remain out of his love for us. The great irony of Jacob's story is that the moment that looked like his greatest defeat became the moment that he finally changed. Jacob spent his entire life trying to seize blessings for himself. But real transformation in his life only began when he stopped trying to control everything and surrendered himself wholly to God. This is the paradox at the heart of discipleship. As Jesus said in Matthew 16, 25, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it." The life we are desperately trying to preserve using our own control and all of that endless striving, you will discover eventually that it just keeps slipping right through your fingers. But when we finally surrender ourselves to God, we discover the life that we were actually created for. And I wonder if that's where some of you are this morning. You are exhausted from trying to hold your life together, trying to manage your disappointments and fears. And you've been working so hard to make life work on your own terms. But perhaps God, in his mercy, has brought you to the end of your own strength, just like he did with Jacob, so that you might finally cling to him as Jacob did. Discipleship begins, in other words, when we stop asking Jesus to help him build the life that we've already claimed, and instead surrendering ourselves completely to the life that he wants for us. The goal of your life, in other words, is ultimately not your comfort and your success, but your Christ-likeness. And the good news of the gospel is that God is absolutely committed to completing that work in you, even through the struggles that he's going to ask you to go through in your life. Let's pray.